My name is Reed Young, and my favorite thing about Earthbound is the theme of friendship, in spite of and as a result of really weird circumstances and odds.
I love Earthbound because it's one of those games that you can keep going back to over and over. There's just so many layers to it that you can appreciate and discover that you can keep going back to the game over and over and not get bored.
Hey there, this is Jenna. My online name is Silverlily. I do fan gamer slips. Moreover, I just really felt that it emphasized on your inner child. You know, you're little, you have superpowers, you just go out on this big adventure. You're with your friends, you're out all times, day and night, and it's just really cool.
Hey, Fan Gamer Podcast, it's me, Kevin Chai. Earthbound is a wonderful game, but never mind that. Are you using that mushroom on your head? I'll buy it for $50. That's it for now. See you later.
This is Melissa King, and one thing I really like about Earthbound is the humor they have in the game. I like that you can fight things like road signs and abstract art and New Age retro hippies that fight you with rulers that are completely ineffective.
Hi, I'm Dan, and I love Earthbound because it allows me unmediated access to a world where people say things like, "What is a dungeon? This is my eternal question."
Hey, my name's Jonathan. I go online by the username ProtonJohn. It was the first proper RPG I ever beat. What I would do is I would go to one of our rental stores in town, and I would rent the game there for a weekend. I finally got through the whole game just based on weekends alone. It was unlike any game I'd ever played before, and it pretty much led to me getting to other RPGs like Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy VI, so that means a lot.
This is Dan the Man. I immediately started playing it, and I was amazed. I mean, how could I have missed this? You know, if you grew up, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, I mean, when I was a kid, I used to go out in the forest, turn big rocks over and find snakes. I even used to catch snakes. So, like, you know, the coiled snake, it's crazy.
Other than the standard plot to save the world from evildoers, there's little about Earthbound that's similar to any role-playing game. It's clear from early on that Earthbound isn't written by some hack video game scribe, but by Shigesato Itoi, a former copywriter who understands and appreciates language. A friend of mine, an animator, prefers the films of Miyazaki to Pixar, because he prefers movies that bear the mark of one man rather than a collective. The toy signature is all over the place. Earthbound is nothing if not honest.
Hi, my name is Garrett Rosa, former podcast editor-in-chief. It really evokes some of the best human emotions in a video game. The fact that it does it really honestly is what allows you to really find the jokes it makes really humorous, the things it does that are clever, enjoyable. There's a lot of love and attention taken. It just really respects the player's time. When you get too strong for an area and you come back, they run away from you in fear. And it's just one of those games that luckily the art style they chose really just helps it age really, really well. I think even 10 years from now, people will go back and enjoy playing.
My name is John Magrum. The reason I like Earthbound so much is how weird it is. I'd never played a game that A, took place in contemporary times, and B, made sure that every detail was something funny or interesting or engaging. Totally blew my top off.
Hey there, this is Cap from Nerdy Show. Falling in love with Earthbound was as important as growing up listening to the Beatles, warping humor with Monty Python, getting into Talking Heads, or being terrified by Alien. Because it combines all these experiences into something utterly brilliant and truly original. Shigesato Itoi made a game like no other. It's one of the 20th century's greatest masterpieces.
Hi, it's John Brentz from SMBC Theater and Ogiku. I love Earthbound so much because it is simply one of the most beautiful stories of childhood, friendship, courage, and adventure ever told. It not only inspired me to become a storyteller myself, but also introduced me to an amazing community of passionate and creative individuals that I now call my closest friends.
All right, I'm Jack Murphy. I'm an aspiring game designer. You know, nowadays the whole world's been explored. Then Earthbound came out, and that really sort of reawakened the excitement and adventure around in everyday life. Not only that, but it made you believe that adventure was anywhere. And just the whole world's rich with experiences, keeps you dreaming, and every day I live to make the world a little bit like that.
Hi, this is Angie, and my favorite aspect of Earthbound is the concept of home. What I appreciated about the game is they incorporated homesickness, which makes you relate to the game a lot more.
Hey guys, it's Pyro Guy. Another reason I love Earthbound is simply the goofs. These little moments where you see an NPC say something totally wacky or uncover a new line of dialogue if you're playing through it again creates an intimate experience that I don't believe the game has ever gotten to yet since.
Hey, Fangamer, this is Dax Glax. What kind of endears it to me is that it's got a very childlike sense of adventure and exploration, the sense that there are things that you learn in childhood that will enable you to succeed in life no matter what dark place you might find yourself. And it's just sort of that
bright, shining philosophy that always manages to take me back whenever I play it.
Hey, what's up? It's Sarah, a.k.a. Fire Girl. And when Earthbound came around, it's like, hey, it's about this kid in shorts and a t-shirt. It could be any one of us. So it was great. It was really relatable. And to this day, the one thing I remember the most was the password for Grapefruit Falls.
Hey, it's Johnny Weiss. That was the first game I ever played that really gave me emotions. When your name pops on the screen and it says you start praying, couldn't stop the tears.
My name is Derek Alexander, and I'm the happy video game nerd. The best part for me is the gorgeous and eclectic soundtrack. With Home Sweet Home, when you're eating steak with mom, or kind of structure the entire game around these soundstones, and they create an inspired yet simple, such a beautiful melody. And it's the simple melodies that are the most difficult ones to write. And tonally, it's such an interesting soundtrack. All the music that surrounds the confrontation with Gygas stands in such incredible contrast to, say, Home Sweet Home, which is appropriate because you couldn't be further from home. The best video games use their soundtracks to illustrate to the player that you are at the final area, that it all ends here. When you fight Gygas, there's the feeling of a heartless machine percolating and beeping. So from top to bottom, Earthbound just oozes with personality and creativity, but the glue that holds it all together, that bow that ties everything together, is the soundtrack.
My favorite part of Earthbound is the very end, because when I was 5 years old and I played the game, the second time I beat it, I broke down in tears, and that is the only time a video game has ever made me cry. And I remember running up to my dad, and I said, "It's so beautiful," and then he hugged me.
Earthbound was the first RPG I ever played. Me and my friends rented it, and we just stayed up all night, and there was this one game on the cartridge that was all the way at Lost Underworld, and we're like, we've got to get there.
Like, everyone who's played it comes away with something. It's created so many beautiful things. Like, people have gotten married because of this stupid video game. Like, fan gamer is a thing because of it. I started making fan music with just, like, me and my voice, and I've composed music for games now because of Earthbound. We've all met each other because of this great thing, and it's fantastic.
Hi, my name is Lindsay, and my favorite part of Earthbound was Peaceful Rust Valley. Not.
Hello, my name is Jeff Benson. Welcome to the Fangamer Podcast. This is episode 140. Today we're going to be discussing Earthbound, its history, why people like it, and why we personally like it as well. And for those of you who have not played Earthbound, I recommend playing it before listening to this because there will be merciless spoilers. So, as usual, I am joined with Ben and Charlie. Today we're also joined by a very special guest, Lindsay Nelson. Lindsay is here talking with us about Earthbound and her experiences in Japan.
Yes. Hi.
Ben, you talked to a bunch of people about Earthbound.
I did. People I knew who have intimate experiences with the game, who would have a few things to say about why it's special to them, or why they love the game. Obviously, Earthbound's a very important game to basically everyone who's played it. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think it's a game that's possible to really play without it affecting you in some sort of way. Like, certainly some people don't like it, but those it does resonate with, they carry it with them for a very long time. And, I mean, Fangamer's really a testament to that, right?
Yeah, like, yeah. I think the people who don't like the game, they just never finished it.
Yeah.
Like, if you finish Earthbound, it's hard for it not to affect you in some way.
Mm.
Just because it's such a personal experience. My dad, he loved playing Earthbound, not because he liked to beat it, but because he just liked to play it.
Mm-hmm.
He would come home from work, and he would play through the game, and I recall always seeing him defeat Gygas and then immediately start a game afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really hear about people doing that. I mean, he just kind of played it on loop in that sense. And it kind of made sense to me, though. The game is a lot more fun to explore than it is to play as a game. It's something you kind of just go and exist within.
Yeah. It's easy to do that.
There's so many different characters in it. In the segment that we're going to be listening to soon with Lindsay Nelson, one of the things we will talk about is how Earthbound is not about any one thing in particular, but rather about people and relationships.
Yeah, I like how vague the goal is in this game. You don't even know what the bad guy is.
Yeah, you never really see him till the very end. He doesn't have
even
a presence.
Then, he isn't terribly obvious in the first place. It's very nebulous. He's all around. He's maybe got this suggestion of a face. It's very vague.
Right.
This might be kind of what he looks like. But really, he's sort of a Lovecraftian horror bigger than you can really imagine.
Like, he's not even... He doesn't even get the chance to be a villain more than he just is the embodiment of evil.
Right. It's not even a villain.
Yeah. He doesn't do anything, really, other than, I guess, have influence with his essence.
And with a evil character like that, or the bad guy within a game like that, the game has a lot of potential to say some pretty profound things about people. Lindsay, you were saying that Itoi, this was pretty much his creation.
He basically just had a team assigned to him that could put all of his ideas into form, but it was him running the whole show.
Growing up, you say this in the segment, you decided that you wanted to go to Japan for various reasons. Something rather magical happened once you actually got into Japan. Maybe we ought to listen to that segment right now so people know exactly what your backstory is.
My name is Lindsay, and I'm known online as Chewy.
So tell me about why you decided to travel to Japan.
In the beginning, it was about middle school and high school that I had gotten into anime and comics and all that. So it was sort of around then that I thought I wanted to study Japanese, but going to Japan wasn't even a thought in my mind because I thought that would be too cool. It's just the really stereotypical common way was the same for me. So that was why I started studying Japanese. And then when I got to college, I majored in it. And once you hit college, the possibilities of stuff you can do pretty much, there's no limit to what you can do at that point because you have so many resources. So I thought, well, what the heck, I'll study abroad. So it was actually super easy for me to get over to Japan, so I studied abroad for about a year and a half, and that was pretty much it for me. I knew that Japan was a part of me and that would never go away, so it's not really a hobby or a part-time job or whatever. It's just sort of, I kind of feel half Japanese at this point, and some people might snub their nose at me for saying that, but when you live in a country, it sort of becomes a part of you. So after that study abroad experience, I knew that it was more than just anime. So I'm in Japan and finding magazines with articles and books written by Shigesato Itoi, and everything he's done with his work, aside from his copywriting for other companies, it's just been him talking about stuff really casually. A lot of interviews with him about his Mother series. He sort of explains how his goal with these was just to portray people. It's not really a set goal other than just about life, and that's a little harder to say with a lot of the RPG series. That also was something that was really fascinating to me, to be reading all this and seeing how I had noticed all these things since I was 10 years old and I didn't really realize that I did. So that was a lot of my life in Japan, was just reading about it and finding information that I'm hoping I can bring back to the States with me and sort of write about and share with people, because all of this information is out there and there hasn't been anyone that's translated it, and that's all there is. So it was about 2 years ago that I had written a letter to his office with a sample translation of a story of his from Let's Meet in a Dream, a collection of short shorts that he and Haruki Murakami had written and did this collection of stories. So I sent in a letter with an excerpt of one of the stories asking for permission to submit it to a literary magazine. My original intention was really hoping that they wrote me a letter back, and I was assuming it was going to be a rejection letter because the guy's too famous, etc., etc. So I was really hoping that I could get a rejection letter with letterhead of his office and be like, you guys, check this out. I have this rejection letter from Itoy's office. And I was really, really hoping for that. So that's what I was thinking. And I sent this letter out that I immediately got a reply through email from his office saying, oh, sure, that's fine. You can send that out if you want. Also, will you come over? And so I read this email about 20 times, thinking, wait a minute, I just wanted my rejection letter. What's going on? So they sent me this email, and I'm reading this at work, trying to keep a straight face. And I think, I don't know, if anyone had looked at me at that point, they'd wonder what was happening to me. But it all happened really fast. So it was a week after that that they invited me to the office, and they didn't tell me if Itoy was going to be there or not, so I was just having an aneurysm this entire time, and I was having, like, anxiety attacks, and it was intense. So I go to his office, really, really nervous, and we have, I mean, long story short, 2 hours later, he wasn't there the whole time. So I really wish I would have known that, because I couldn't breathe the whole time, and then they left, and that was it. And, yeah, so that happened about 4 more times, just him continually not being there. But let me rewind a little bit and say why I was there. That was just something really important to me. So, First of all, I had been using the daily planner from his office for about 3 years at that point, because it's their flagship biggest product is this planner. And they told me, which I had no idea was coming, that they were making an English version. So we've got the number one selling planner in Japan, which is Itoy's company's, and they asked me to be the translator for this. There isn't even a team there. They're just, we need someone to make an English version of this planner. Will you do it? And I always have this planner on me because I'm just a huge fan of it, so I just pull it out, and they're like, oh, good, you know what this is. I'm like, absolutely, I would love to do it. So,
is that what's in front of you right now?
Yes, and so I always have it with me. So it's just this 365-page daily planner. This is available in English now, and there's a website up, and I'm going to do some polishing on the explanations and everything, so this is still sort of a work in progress. I got my foot in the door through his company through that letter I had sent out explaining how I was a fan of Itoy and his games and his work, and I believed that overseas audiences really wanted to see what he had to offer. And they saw in that letter that I had background knowledge of Itoy and I was a fan of his. And he's such a strange guy that if you don't know who he is and what he's done, it's so hard to translate him because he's just too quirky. So to them, they were really grateful that they had found this native English speaker that was actually an Itoy fan, which there's not a whole lot of those in Japan. I have met Shigesato Itoy 2 times now, and the second time I met him, I actually got to sit down and talk with him. The first time was just a lot of fangirling, but the second time I was in his office, and he set aside about 10 minutes to talk with me, and he had never sat down with a foreign fan before and talked about his games. So for him, also, it was a really new and fascinating experience. And the very first thing he asked me is, what drew me to Earthbound, or what I liked about the game? And it was a little embarrassing how hard it was to answer the question, but because there's a lot there. But one of the things I told him was how easy it was to get sucked into this game because of the American setting. And he kind of thought, he never really thought of it before, because something about Shigesato Itoy that a lot of people might not know is he grew up in Gunma Prefecture, which is a really country, bumpkin countryside with a whole... There's not a whole lot there. Everyone has this sort of end goal when they're young, because you've got the people that dream of going off to New York City or basically the big city, or going off to other countries, and there's always this mysterious place that's bigger than you and what you know, and you're sort of aiming to go there. And to Itoi, that was Tokyo. So you've got this country bumpkin Japanese boy who dreams of going to Tokyo, and he gets older and he builds his career and makes a name for himself, and eventually he moves to Tokyo and he starts his own company there. And to Itoi, that was a really big deal and he had reached his achievement. So to him, that end goal was Tokyo, because it was such a giant world. He had never even thought about the concept of basically connecting with people outside of Japan, because it sounded a little like what I had thought when I was first into Japan, and I thought, well, it's awesome and stuff, but it might not even exist. It's just this fairy tale land of wacky things, and it couldn't possibly be real, so I'm just gonna think it's really neat. But there's always some place that's a little too mysterious and you can't quite imagine it. And to him, it was everything outside of Japan. So he had never really thought about overseas fans liking his work before, and he was really fascinated to hear that I was such a big fan. And I just kept telling him over and over how many fans there are overseas and how much we really want to see his work. And it was a little hard to say the entire situation, because I was telling him that it was really hard only having one of the games of the three overseas, and people were so desperate to play Mother 3 that they were using a text file while they were playing their Game Boy Advance game in Japanese and following through with this text file. They just wanted to play it so bad. And he's like, wow, it's amazing. I'm like, thinking, well, someone out there is using that method, but... So I was sort of just trying to show him how much it's wanted out there, and he was telling me, wow, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize people wanted it so bad. And he knew that we didn't have Mother 1 and we didn't have Mother 3, and so he was aware of that, but he didn't know that it was a big deal. So I was basically trying to tell him that it is a really big deal, and I wasn't quite sure to what extent he was taking it, because I sort of get this feeling, because he also was laughing like, oh man, and I'm best friends with Miyamoto, ah ha ha ha. I'm like, come on, you're killing me. And because he is like best friends with Miyamoto and he's best friends with Iwata, and they could they probably have an actual button that they press to translate Mother 3 and send it over here. So I'm trying to hint to him that wherever that button is that I know he has, all he has to do is press it, but I'm not sure I got to that point, because it was just, it was really fast. And like I said before, this whole internationalization concept is so new to him that he might not quite be taking it seriously yet. I had asked an employee a few meetings before whether they had gotten that PK Siege box, when we sent his office a giant box full of translated fan-made things to show them how much we loved Earthbound.
That was a Starman.net.
Yes, I believe it was 2007 that Starman.net did this as a collaborative effort. And it took a ton of effort. We had a Japanese woman do all of our translations for this giant book that we wrote and all that. And so I asked the coworker who we had originally sent it to in 2007. I believe we had mailed it to her name at the office, and she was racking her brain trying to remember if she ever got a box like that. And I'm like, you don't forget when you get a box from America with just this explosion of Earthbound fan-made things. That's not something you forget about, because I promise it only happens one time. So yeah. She mostly remembered it, and I really regret when I met Itoi not having asked him directly whether he had seen it or not. I think I was still sort of being very subtle about people only using text files to play Mother 3 and all that, and I'm like, I'm not quite sure what's going to start making things uncomfortable, but so I think if I ever talk to him again, I'm going to ask about that. A lot of our talks was just sort of him being impressed. There was sort of like half confusion, half being really impressed. There wasn't a whole lot of substance to our conversation. It was just, I was trying to emphasize how much everyone really loved his games. He was super surprised to hear that and that people were even thinking about him, so.
Did you find out if he had ever heard of Starman.net?
Yes. And that is another thing. Well, luckily I went in having seen that video where he had mentioned Starman.net before.
The Starman Club.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm glad I had seen that video because now I came in there with the context of knowing what this Starman Club is, that being us. And I had heard not only from him but his coworkers, and his coworkers are all very close with him. It's sort of just they could answer a lot of questions on his behalf. So they thought it was hilarious that we're posting pictures of their office for Earthbound fans because to them, Itoi and his office are disconnected enough from the Mother series that they're surprised that people who are interested in the game are interested in them. And to us, there's a huge connection there.
But the office itself had nothing to do with the games.
Right, and so they were really surprised to hear that they even cared about that. So yeah, they do know of us, and so I had known that Itoi knew about the Starman Club, and when I met him during our little meeting, that's when I asked him to sign that autograph board as a message to everyone in the Starman Club, because I dared not say Starman.net, because the moment Itoi said Starman Club, we are no longer Starman.net. We are the Starman Club. So he wrote that board for us, and that is our rebirth.
You presented that to Reed at
PAX
in Seattle.
Yeah, so that was a wonderful moment. It was so hard keeping that a secret for months on end until I went to PAX, but it was worth it. So now we have the holy grail of the direct message to everyone at the Starman Club, and he gave me the autograph board, and then he said, that was right before he had to go back to his work, and he just said, tell everyone overseas that I said hi. And I said, I will do that, you wonderful man. Everything he does is so casual.
Has the meaning of Earthbound changed for you at all?
Honestly, even though so much has changed in that regard, I really don't think what Earthbound is to me has really changed all that much, which sort of proves to me that it has been a part of me. Nothing's ever really going to touch that. I would hope that people who are going to be playing it for the first time can sort of approach it from a naive sense and go in as if they have something to learn from it, because you start taking too many things for granted, and I think we still have a lot of things to learn about relationships and ourselves and all that, and that's why I think it's best to go in just with that naive part of you that might have gone away since then, just sort of approaching it as a 10-year-old.
This has been great. It's so nice to hear from the only known Westerner that has met Itoi and able to work with him in some capacity.
Yeah.
Was he what you expected?
He was absolutely what I expected. I hope that there's a lot to come. I feel like there is. So this is just the beginning.
Thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you.
So Shinsato Itoi, we just heard a bunch about him. Like, he's not a person who makes games. Like, he made the Mother series and then a fishing game. But, right. Like, that's not what he does. But the people that he got involved to also make it also weren't people who made video games. Like, Keiichi Suzuki, one of the main composers for the game, like, he's not a games composer. Like, this is the only game he's ever written music for. He's in, like, a rock band called the Moonriders, I think. Mm-hmm. Everyone on the team seems to just bring, like, this fresh perspective that, like, you wouldn't get from other game makers.
Lindsay, do you know why he decided to make this game or this series of games?
It was basically a whim. So when it was first in the beginning in the 80s with Mother 1, he just had this really great idea for a story. And so he was working with Nintendo on other projects like copywriting and just writing gigs that he was doing with Nintendo. One day he just thought, well, I have an appointment to go there. I'm just going to bring this script with me. So he just sort of went in on a whim and said, hey, I have this really great story. And he got to meet Miyamoto because they had worked together with the other projects.
It's all very unconventional.
Yeah, so I always kind of figured that he was asked or something, but no. He just decided to do it.
Yeah, so that's why I think there's all that much more love to it, because he just really wanted to do it.
Yeah, and that really comes across. And when we were talking about it during your segment, and to just say it's about people and relationships, it's such an open-ended, ambiguous, but specific enough approach to where I can see now why so many people like it.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why people feel so attached to it, and when they grow up with it, they really have a fond memory of feeling like they were growing up in a game. Charlie, you're freaking out right now. Update us on...
Because he just knocked me...
Charlie's playing Earthbound right now.
Yeah, we're getting the juices.
I was just blew through like 50 cops, and then suddenly Strong just grappled me, put me in a submission hold, and killed me.
Okay. 20 years later.
Emotional investment, everybody.
So this actually brings up an interesting point I've always liked about Earthbound. And in the more recent years of looking at this game critically, it's a lot more noticeable because I've learned more about the world. But this game exposes you to a lot of situations that you'll actually find in reality.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty
like
cool.
Like the last time you got in a fight with a bunch of cops.
Right. Not many people get Not many people get in fights with cops, but there are moments in history where there have been corruption within a police force, for instance. It's a little slight, elegant truth about reality.
Yeah. It's a caricature.
Right.
It's about people.
Right, it's about people, and then you have...
you have people in authority that abuse it.
Right. Which is interesting because in the beginning of the game, you start off as this boy who is basically told, you're going to save the world and you're the hero, you're the world savior. And Charlie and I have talked about this many times. Ben doesn't totally agree with this. I'd like to hear Lindsay's take on it. I've kind of gotten the impression over the years that Ness, though he doesn't speak within the game, he's a very enthusiastic kid who's very gung-ho about being a hero, and he's willing to just kick anybody's butt and essentially resort to violence in order to achieve saving the world.
So you think he's just a big dummo, is what you're saying?
Sure, well, I mean, in a very...
How would anybody react being told that they're going to be a hero? I mean, some people, like, you see that, and several games address this idea. Like, you're told you're going to be a hero, you have a few different ways you're going to react. You're going to be like, all right, I'm a hero. And
but
you're
going
to go
I
do
feel
it.
Like the method of which he was told that was through, like, this beetle that came from the future that was then murdered in front of him.
Right.
And, like...
You just put that segment earlier, right, in the game. And I immediately said, let's recap what has happened. My name is Ness. A meteor crash landed in my backyard, and then a magical beetle came out who said he was from the future and told me, I'm going to save the world because I'm a hero. And then he gets killed. That's pretty bizarre.
It messed my head, actually, when I was little.
Yeah, I
felt really strengthened by all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, he's going to guide me. And then just bam, he's gone. Yeah. I'm like, well, now I'm just completely helpless.
Right.
You don't think that scares him a little bit?
I think it would scare him, but I don't think he would necessarily... I don't think Ness would immediately be the classic hero. I think he's going to be a flawed character at this point, because we're still in the beginning.
Here's the interesting thing, is having that Mother 2 novel as a supplement to this, which I'm still working on getting out, but here you have this novel that Itoi had personally endorsed and has the Nintendo logo on it and everything, and it's an extremely just vast a departure from the game, but since the whole novel is written first person from Ness's point of view, all of a sudden you have this entire new approach to the game that we didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And it really emphasizes the fact that it's kind of a strange position for Ness to be in, but you have to take into account that his dad is gone, and he starts out as this really gung-ho kid because he's obsessed with...
<He's> yes! Validation!
Exactly.
Damn it.
But his entire life revolves around protecting his mom and his sister.
Yeah.
So it's not even about saving the world. It's like, I need to make sure my family's safe.
And I imagine that has something to do also when he meets Paula.
Yeah.
He saves Paula, and I've gotten the impression that Ness kind of just assumes that they're going to be dating now or something, or that they're boyfriend and girlfriend.
I don't know about that.
You know, I don't want to bring that part out of the Mother 2 novel, because it gets really freaky Japanese shoujo.
Really?
Yeah.
What? I want to know.
You have all the boys chasing Paula, and there's a lot of blushing.
All within the Chosen Four?
Yeah, except for Pooh, I think. So maybe it was just Jeff.
Oh my god.
I don't know,
it gets
really weird.
Oh man, in my fanfic I wrote about that.
It gets really weird. There's a lot of blushing.
Yeah. Okay.
That sounds so doki doki.
No, yeah. at some point.
No, I think he's scared of her.
Ness?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. I think anybody would be scared of Paula because Paula is she's probably the most powerful out of any of them.
Yeah.
Like,
definitely.
Not just in terms of she can shoot fire or, you know, have fire. Ice and lightning emerge from her being.
She's a totally defensive person.
But she can also emotionally control high-profile people like Monotoli, for instance. Yeah. She can resort to things without violence. So she's very powerful.
It's so great that, like, you said that. Because when I was a kid, when I first talked to Paula, I was scared of her, too. Just because of the way she talks.
She's in a cage.
She's, like, really assertive, right? And, like, that's awesome. But, like, when I played the game as a kid, and I portrayed this in Fabies are Orange with Paula just being a jerk. But like the way like she's like, now go kick butt, like I know you can. Like
she's different in the Japanese version.
Is it?
She's a little more like crying.
Yeah,
and
she says if you didn't come, I would have started to cry. And in the American version,
I would have had to break out of here.
Which is actually kind of weird because her personality and the way she leads the group is that I would have had to bust out of here type. So it's kind of a strange inconsistency in the Japanese version. Mm.
Huh.
I'm glad they changed that then, because
I can see people getting mad about changing something like that. But
that's always been a part that's confused me because I've looked into the differences between the two games, and I felt like that was a major point when her character is not only being introduced physically, but she's saying something about herself that's indicative of how she reacts to stress.
She's a captured princess, but she's willing to break herself out.
Right.
If somebody's not going to be coming.
One sounds like
she's not
going to
let herself
give up.
get killed.
It's like, I'm either going
to
give up or
I'm
going
to succeed. But then
I wonder
if it was just Itoi was trying to add more of a character development. Because here we have less character development, where she's already like that. And I think maybe the Japanese version was supposed to be more that she was a crybaby in the beginning, and then she sort of gets her act together as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
She was obviously pretty overprotected.
Yeah.
By her parents.
Yeah.
But she's kind of famous too, right?
She's famous.
She kind of has to.
She's overprotected by her parents. Her dad is a very emotional person. Whereas her mother is pretty accepting of situations. Like when Paula's disappeared, she's kind of trusting that she'll just return.
That's not my fault, buddy.
Whereas the dad freaks out once he finds out to the point where he runs down the street calling her name.
Yeah, he's intimidating.
Yeah. So I can totally relate to Paula being like, well, yeah, I want to go save the world with this guy, Ness.
Yeah.
Because what is here for me besides... Pampering. Family is good, but, you know...
Being pampered.
Yeah, exactly.
She wants to see more than that.
Right. What do you guys think her character arc is? I've thought about this for a long time.
Well, she is the most difficult one to say anything about that for, because she's the only one you never actually control.
Yeah, which... interesting in itself.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think you guys really sort of hit the nail on the head that, like, I mean, she's sort of trying to prove to herself that she is independent and doesn't really need her parents to pamper her.
By the end, she does need them. They need everybody,
right.
Truly.
Yeah, you're never truly independent, are you?
Mm-hmm. Right. Talking about how you can't play as a girl character or a female character in a game called Mother is pretty interesting. And I think that speaks to...
how this game was crafted. Is there anything that you know about that, Lindsay?
I don't, and I'm interested to keep looking into that in my nerd research. But if I were to make a personal opinion about that, I wouldn't be surprised if Itoi was just intimidated by having to write from a girl's perspective.
Mm. But he does at a few certain points anyway. Like if Paul's the only character alive, or like if Ness is dead.
Right, Charlie brought up the point that you can play as Paula, mm-hmm. but you have to put effort into it and get the other three characters, or however many are in your party, you have to get them killed.
That's mm-hmm. not plot related, though.
No, it's not. No. But some of the dialogue apparently changes
when
you play as Paula in that way. So as we continue through the game and we get another character in our party named Jeff, the Jeff character is much different from Ness in that he has issues with his dad, and he just has no mother figure in his life.
Yeah.
Whereas Ness has a mother figure in his life who he lives with, and his dad who is very supportive, and they talk on the phone. But Jeff has not talked to his dad in years. In fact, his dad has pretty much abandoned him.
Even though he's just down the street.
Down the lake.
Yeah.
And the impression I get from this character is he really feels that he has more to offer
mm-hmm.
than just being a student at this private school.
Though he doesn't
where everybody
really
pretty much talks very highly of his father.
Yeah, he doesn't really know what it is yet, though. Because, like, when you first meet him, like, he's very self-conscious, right? It's like, nerdy, you know, not very strong. Mm-hmm. Will you still be my friend?
Mm-hmm. He's one of the only characters that really describes himself to you when you meet him.
Yeah.
The way that Jeff is introduced is just done very elegantly in the game.
I think so.
Because you have to do this magnificent little escape out of, you know, the rooms. And you have to journey through the wilderness. And eventually you get to the Tessie Watching Club. And this is perhaps my favorite part of Jeff being introduced. And a lot of people's, I think, because of Tessie. Because
first of all, dinosaur.
Well, yes, dinosaurs are cool. I think what's fascinating about this is that Jeff, I get the impression he wants more out of life. Mm-hmm. He wants to offer more. He goes, meets up with the Tessie Watching Club, stays in their tent, and they're like, we've been here for X amount of days, weeks, maybe even years.
Yeah.
Who knows how long they've been trying to find this dinosaur.
And then Jeff
shows up with a monkey. They have some bubble gum. And then Tessie goes, hey, man, go ahead and get on my back. And then he takes him all the way to go see his dad. And during that ride, I would imagine Jeff pretty much going, hell yeah, this is what I'm looking at. You know, this is what I'm looking for. Like, this is the sense of adventure that I'd want to have.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's another person who has an ability to accomplish things without violence, right? That's not what he does. He fixes things. And he,
even though he makes great weapons.
Right. But that's not all he makes.
Right.
Yeah,
he makes lots of great defensive items, too.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
his best weapons aren't things that he makes. They're things that you get from arms dealers.
So, yeah, it's true.
He solves a lot of problems without violence, whether he's using Tessie or fixing the Skyrunner or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He's an interesting character.
Right. Lindsay, what's your take on the Jeff Andonet's character?
Something that was interesting with the scene changes like that is that it was always really jarring to me every time they do a scene change with a new character and all mm-hmm. of a sudden I'm somewhere completely different. So when I was playing this when I was young, I felt really kind of freaked out that I was in this boarding house when I should have been in bed and I'm wandering around and stuff. Like, I felt like I was going to get caught. So I felt sort of like on edge. And then I think what really struck me is, like, Jeff meets his father, then you sort of realize how kind of messed up it is that he wasn't at boarding school. Because you're like, wait a minute, you've been here this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of sent off like that. So that was another thing that it was sort of a mix of having this modern setting that I could sort of insert myself into emotionally, and then having something like that happen where it sort of makes me emotionally react to a situation that I otherwise wouldn't have been exposed to.
Yeah.
So that really touched me in that way.
Yeah. He's one of those characters where you can't, it's hard to dislike him, but you know that he's doing something just pretty awful to his son.
Yeah,
that was really something to me too, is that he's such a likable character, and he talks so nice, and he's so nice to his son and everything, but the whole concept of what's going on here.
He's a space bat. I mean, that's what he is.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of an
Actually, now that you mention that, that's actually a really interesting point that I've never thought of before, because A lot of people know about how he had a daughter that made Mr. Saturn's font.
Right.
But I don't know if it was related to him being famous and having a busy schedule or if it was just a family situation, but his daughter wasn't really in his life a whole lot. Mm. And so he sort of brought her in to do that, and maybe it was a bonding thing. But other than that, he was sort of a detached person. So I would be really interested if that had an effect on the Andonuts character.
I mean, I know that, that's what inspired the dad, like Ness's dad character. Where
really?
Yeah.
You primarily, you only ever see him through the phone.
To the point where, in the ending credits, he just is a phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all you can think of for your dad.
That was.
Yeah, yeah.
Just waiting for it, and then,
At least in Earthbound Zero, we got to see some dude in a coat.
So, Jeff joins up in the party, and I'm interested to hear how in the novelization he reacts to Paula and Jeff, or Paula and Ness, because when I was doing Earthbound Saga 5, which ultimately was shelved as a project, the original script I was working off of, I had thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if Jeff liked Paula? Like, he had a crush on Paula, but Ness also had a crush on Paula. And these three are supposed to go and save the world.
Yeah.
And I thought that would be pretty fascinating because you'd have these two guys who are pretty much superficially invested in these emotions and this girl who just wants to do the right thing and pretty much has to ignore them.
So do you think that Jeff wanted to be the hero?
In a way, I wrote him that way in the script.
I feel like that's the only possible way to interpret two boys being exactly in puberty age
with
a girl all the time. The thing that
which
was
one
funny
of us is the main character?
The thing that was kind of funny in the novel is it totally emphasized, because it loved making them all nervous about each other, it loved emphasizing the fact that they go stay in hotels together.
Aww.
Total freak out every time that happened.
It's adorable.
That sounds great.
Yeah, there was probably like a chapter long of just them being super nervous about having to sleep by each other.
God, that sounds like everything I want to read ever.
And I have like some spoilers about the novel that I could give tidbits of. So, this goes back to the relationship between Jeff and his father.
Uh-huh.
But long story short, Jeff is a paraplegic.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, so, nobody can see this except for people watching our live chat. I just totally freaked out. Holy crap.
You've got basically, I don't know, Forrest Gump. He can't move his legs.
Oh, God.
So what happens is he struggles super hard. So you have to make it through the forest and everything. Imagine doing that without being able to move your legs.
Is he in a wheelchair?
He's in a wheelchair, and here's the thing, is that it introduces Tony as a caregiver. He still loves Jeff and everything, but he has to let him do everything. He even has to change his clothes for him. It's super intimate.
That sounds so good.
My mind is totally blown right now. I gotta go walk around this room.
So you've got this whole new dynamic. Things get a lot deeper. And then he struggles to get south without being able to move, and he does it on
his own. Is it on his own?
No, it's with the help of everyone, because they donate a super snowmobile, which was the treasure of the school.
Oh, so they actually helped him leave.
Yes. So place. Everyone comes together and helps him because they know he can't walk. So he's on this snowmobile and
does he still ride Tessie?
Yeah. On the snowmobile. So here's the thing, is that once he makes it to the lab, Dr. Andonuts makes up for everything by rebuilding him into a bionic man to say, I'm sorry for abandoning you. And he's really cold the whole time. It's amazing. So, because he's just, it's more real because all of a sudden he's got his son back and he doesn't know what to do with him. Which actually in the game it might be a little weird that he's so familiar with him after abandoning him.
Yeah,
That's what made it so jarring, is like something deeper is going on here, even though they're being so cordial to each other. So he rebuilds his legs and then he's okay for the rest of the game.
So once he leaves the school, that's when his legs get rebuilt. And then he goes to 3.
Yeah, here's the thing. It's such a huge departure, but Itoi is still behind all this stuff. So this goes back to him making this game as something that doesn't have a specific goal to it, and he wants people to just experience it. And every single time someone tries making a theory about the game, people love their theories, he never invalidates it. He's like, well, it is what you guys think it is. And that's always his answer. So you can say whatever you want. People are always like, Nintendo? Is he Ness's dad? Or whatever, all that stuff. He always says, it is what you think it is. And so people can struggle to make their answers to explain things in the game, but there's never going to be an actual answer. And so it's interesting to see him
behind these novels that go so nuts with all the stuff about the game.
We're kind of skipping over Pooh as a character right now. Yeah. I feel like we shouldn't.
Well, he'd be cool with it because he's Pooh.
Yeah, it's true. He's the most yeah, yeah. I'll just say this about Pooh. When he gets involved in the Chosen Four, I just imagine he's kind of like, what the hell did I just fall yeah. into? Because all these, like, the three of them are probably fighting all the time amongst themselves or trying to just figure out things. He pretty much just came from this position where he was, you know, he was a prince and everybody was, you know, falling at his whim. And now I guess I have to stick with these people.
Yeah. I was offended when he left again.
Yeah, a little bit. It's like
what is this? Clearly you were not our friend this whole time.
Like, so. I mean, it wasn't really his choice, though, right? Like,
no,
his master
but
swooped by
to,
and,
a,
okay.
to like a 12-year-old, that's super offensive.
Yeah, to an extent, I was kind of like, I gotta leave. I'll see you guys later. Get me out of here, right?
How many years older is he supposed to be?
It's like 16 or something.
Yeah,
right?
Something like that. Yeah, he is quite older than them.
He is the stoic character who's pretty much from the moment you meet him, he is ready to die to save the world.
Mm-hmm.
He gives up his body, which is something that the other three don't do until the very end of the game, once you have your brain taken out by Dr. Andonuts and put into a robot so you can survive time travel to the beginning of space and time, as I think it's described.
I mean, if I can jump back to the novel just for
yeah.
a quick second, he doesn't really come across as a friend in the novel either. He submits himself to slavery, basically. And so Ness would be like, no, no, it's okay. And then Pooh's like, no, I must do this for my master. And it's super slavery.
That's because
so.
He even says that in the game. And that
yeah.
Ness, I'm here, to, Ness is my master.
Yeah, basically. It's super, like, master territory. And so it doesn't feel like a friend at all.
But I see that being the character arc for him throughout. Like, although the game doesn't really suggest this. I guess it kind of does by the end, though.
He has to kind of get over his superiority complex to them, in a way.
His superiority and his inferior. Like, the fact that he has to be inferior.
Yeah.
Like, he by the end, he is a friend, right?
Yeah, I mean.
Because he is saying kind words, and it's like, hey, you know.
Forget
I'll
you guys.
Yeah, exactly. It's something that I have to work on this PK goodbye.
Yeah. Or maybe he was just like, just playing it up for him. It's like, PK goodbye, see ya!
We get to the end of the game. Now you're in the beginning of everything. And you have to go fight Gygas, which is corrupted existence entirely from its inception. This is one of the most abstract parts of the game.
Really, yeah.
I sort of went through it without knowing what was going on, and I don't think that ever changed. Because, like, I don't know where I am. I don't know what it means to be in the beginning of time. And I can't figure out why the world looks like that. And then you're playing the boss battle and it's saying you could not grasp the form of his attack. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, I can't. And it's just like, I'm just sort of sitting there having my mind blown. So I don't think I've ever reached a point where that made sense for me.
Yeah. Like, there's nothing really to make sense of,
I could try and sit and think about it for a while, but I think it would give me a headache.
Yeah.
But I think I like your interpretation of the end the most, though.
You get to Gygas, and you're faced with the Devil's Machine, which is like an intestinal tract kind of leading up to this machine made of organs.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to be one of the best character designs of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then having his face in it.
Right.
Oh, man.
Exactly. This whole time you've been hearing vicariously through Gygas's minions that he knows who you are, and he does not want you to succeed. And so you have this intimate relationship with Gygas through, you know, people talking about both of you. So you're both aware of each other in this peripheral way, and now you're seeing each other face-to-face, effectively, to the point where Ness's face is in the iris of Gygas. He's in the one big eye. And then Porky comes out.
Yeah.
And I think he just starts making fun of you, right?
Essentially. It's like, are you going to pee your pants?
Right.
Are you scared?
I sure am.
My answer was yes.
So yeah, you have these two characters. You have Gygas, who's supposed to be this embodiment of evil, or just evil incarnate, right?
Yeah.
And then you have...
It's the idea of evil.
Right. Then you have Porky, who is the lead minion, I guess. I don't know what you...
He's the facilitator.
He's the facilitator. I'd like to think of Porky as, in a way, the dark clone of Ness. Because they both come from polar opposite family lives.
Mm-hmm.
Ness came from a family life in which his mother was like, oh, you're going to go out and find a meteor? Perfect. That's great. Just put your pajamas on. That's all I'm asking of you. Porky goes out to check the meteor, and he comes home to be beaten by his father and yelled at.
Wow.
So those are far different home lives. And then they both have this journey together, Ness trying to stop Gygas and Porky trying to facilitate Gygas. So now we find them at the end of the game. I'd like to think of Porky in a way as a projection of kind of the opposite that the player is experiencing as they experience a sense of agency with Ness. How did you guys feel towards Porky specifically at this moment in the game?
Like, I just thought he was gone, really. Like,
gone, like, lost his sanity?
Yeah, like, he's done.
Yeah, the person... like he was just this empty body filled with something that he couldn't identify anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He didn't really look human anymore.
Yeah, he didn't. Point. He was
inside of this weird spider.
Here's another theory, though, is Porky a facilitator, or is he Gygas?
How is that rationalized?
I think he's a bit too immature, and, like, he doesn't have enough finesse to be
I think
Gygas.
He maybe welcomed Gygas too much, to the point where his heart is just full of nothing but hate.
But see, why do you think he did that?
But then there's some theories, which are also touched upon in the novel, that you don't have Gygas and Porky, you have Porky, and he is Gygas.
It's in the novel?
It's touched upon. Mm-hmm. So it's the question of, because everywhere the trouble goes, that's Porky doing it.
That's true.
And
did the evil that started off in the beginning of time ultimately take the form of Porky?
Gosh, that's hard to explain because it's hard to grasp.
It sounds almost like what you're describing, though, in that the evil follows Porky around.
Mm-hmm.
And so if Gygas existed in the beginning of time and space, that has forever existed within everything. Yeah. And so maybe Porky is just the final embodiment that is going to ultimately destroy the world through cults, through corruption and politics, through releasing ancient evils that are within, or ancient powers that are within pyramids, and he just keeps pushing the limits.
He must be very intrinsically attached to the Manny Manny statue. Because the Manny Manny statue was buried in a hill right next to Pokey's house.
Which
right?
gets revealed as soon as the
statue starts moving, then suddenly Pokey's moving. He has no reason to leave Onette. He's afraid to have anything to do with this quest. Because he's a chicken. He doesn't want to have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
But the statue moves, and then Pokey moves with it.
That's true.
Yeah.
And then whenever the statue gets broken, Pokey goes nuts. Like, he steals a helicopter and just goes off.
Right.
Crashes it, poops in the desert. Crashes it in the...
And then I cried.
In the swamp. And then like, that's the last you hear of him until he steals one of the phase distorters, the first completed one. Yeah. And
he starts kidnapping Pete.
When Minnie Miter,
right? When Apple Kid is talking on the phone, he goes, "Wait, hey, get your hands off me." You hear the thum, bum, 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 bum.
Yeah,
that was like a Starman or something that just barged in.
You only hear that when Porky comes.
Yeah, that's sort of his motif, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, that would be another thing that Itoy would be like, it is. Perfect example.
Yeah. So, it's never going to be a clear-cut line if Porky is or is not Gygas, but...
It is what you think.
It is what you think. But I think... what the player feels towards Porky near the end is the beginning of the character arc being experienced by the player.
Mm-hmm.
Porky gets away. He escapes into a totally different dimension. And while that is a really cool thing to have for a sequel, outside of that, just specifically talking about this game, how did you guys feel once he got away? Did you feel like you wanted to see him fail and you felt gypped? Did you feel like you didn't have to worry about him anymore? What were you feeling?
I didn't feel gypped at all. I felt like it was completely inevitable.
Yeah.
Because you've got this person that you grew up with, and it sort of turns into that again, where he has been a part of your life the whole time, and you can't ever stop that from being the truth.
I was always, through the whole game, I sort of viewed Pokey Porky as like a tragic sort of figure that, like, it's really your choice whether or not you interpret him at the beginning of the game as your friend once upon a time.
Mm-hmm.
But I did, always. And whenever I saw him, like, when you meet him in, like, the Monotoli building, like, I just felt sad that this is what had happened to someone who I had assumed to be my friend at a certain point in time.
See, that's a really interesting way to personalize the game, is it's up to you to say, were you friends or were you enemies?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's like a total 50-50 split that I think someone goes down one path or the other.
Right. And I don't think you're really best friends, but it's sort of like how, like, the kids in the treehouse, like, you all know each other, you hang out, they're your neighbors, like,
Pokey was probably just the annoying kid in that group.
Yeah, I mean, he was someone that, I mean,
or even
was
the avoided one, who knows.
Yeah.
Pokey gets away, and I think it's interesting how you have this character that's pretty much this object of ridicule, or this object of kind of negative energy, that the player can, or in some cases, not put in towards that character. But you can defeat Gygas and you can save your dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And it ultimately shoves Porky out of the dimension. However...
But what can Porky do by himself without Gygas?
Right. And obviously Mother 3 is the testament to that. But I don't know. I thought about this recently and I was thinking how if I want to see Porky fail at the end, I feel like that's negative energy that I'd be putting out as opposed to accepting that, okay... He's going to be the way he is, and I can't change that. And at least he's not in this dimension anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But if I want to see him fail and accept his challenge to come find him, I'm just playing into the devil's hands. And I think that is also expressed through, you can't defeat Gygas by fighting him. You have to, instead of fighting, you have to think about your friends and family.
And isn't that just the worst thing for someone like Pokey to be ignored? Like, to send that letter and they're just like,
yeah,
don't feed the trolls. Yeah. Right. So I think not fighting by the end of the game, that to me is what the game is really...
The lesson.
Yeah, expressing. If there was some kind of controlling idea that you can put into a single statement, I think it would be evil begets evil.
And the whole game is really sandwiched with that theme, as most good theming is portrayed, because one of the first things Buzz tells you, it's that, like the three most important virtues are wisdom, courage, and friendship.
Right.
And mostly you hear that wisdom, courage, and power, but power isn't...
Power the virtue. Porky.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's about friendship and the relationships you have.
Right.
And again, it's about people.
There's this article I read years ago that talked about the ending of Earthbound and why it was so fantastic, and part of the thing is that...
Is it because Gygas is a fetus?
No. it has to do with, like, or you play, like, a Final Fantasy game, like Final Fantasy VII, and you get to the end, and basically in the end you're fighting some god, right?
Right. It's JRPG.
And then you kill the god,
mm-hmm.
because... I guess, you know, it's just this concept of this is just a really powerful being. It's not some immortal thing. But then at that point, is it really a god? Yeah. You know? Whereas in Earthbound, I mean, you can't. Nothing. I mean, there's something else to it. You can't beat a god into the dirt. I mean, I guess you could try and think that you're just really that powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess most people who play God of War feel that way about themselves by the time.
At least in the first one.
I know that Itoi wanted to make the Mother series, or at least Earthbound, as realistic as possible. And there's a long list of things that he actually actively worked on to make sure this game, the story of this game, was parallel to the reality that we live in. And I think what really strikes me with Gygas is that when you technically defeat him in the end, you don't really feel like it's gone, because... In this world, there's no such thing as defeating evil. You beat the end, and you can walk around the world, and everything seems better, and it is, and you've restored peace, but it still feels like that peace is temporary, because you know that Pokey's still out there, and it doesn't really feel like everything is completely over. There's not really a sense of closure, and the same with reality, is that everyone can stick together and overcome a tragedy, and everything is peaceful, but you know that it's only a matter of time before that happens again. And it doesn't happen again like history repeats. It's going to happen the same way. It might happen a different way. I think that maybe was a effort to make it more realistic, to have that lack of closure.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most beautiful parts about the game.
You know what's another beautiful part about the game? I just found this sign. To recover or not depends on luck. Believe in your luck. Believe in your doctor also. The doctor believes in his luck. What a wonderful sign to find in the hospital.
Earthbound, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I'd like to just really quick go back to character arcs before we wrap up here. I think by the end, everybody has their own... The Chosen Four each have their own characters that they have to change from. And in the case of, like, Jeff, by the end, he says that he's going to do some research with his dad. Mm-hmm. He's basically going to start being his dad's apprentice, and they're going to work on their relationship together. Pooh takes off, says peace, and, you know...
PK, goodbye.
PK, see ya.
We're
friends now, so he gets over his deal. And then Ness, he gets asked to walk Paula home.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, that's great.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. The mark of a true hero to me is somebody who knows the time to refuse to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the only game I've ever played that allows you to do that, or is required to do that by the end.
Well, the whole series, really.
It's easy to fight for what you believe in. It's even more difficult to believe in not fighting. And that's really what I think is cool about this game.
I can agree with that.
No fighting. There's this guy right here in the hospital. All he says is, I had an argument with my friend about happyism. That's all he said. But he's in the hospital.
Yeah.
He just got into a violent fight about a discussion about religion.
You don't even know which side he's on.
Yeah. This is a brilliant room. I like this room a lot.
Do you think
because it tells a whole story without saying anything.
All right, well, Dan exaggerated in our chat or in the live broadcast. This says, Pokey isn't a tragic figure. He's just a huge dick. I think that's a pretty good note to end on, I guess.
It is what you want it to be.
It is what you want
Earthbound
it to be.
Is what you want it to be. The whole series is.
Yes. Well, any closing thoughts, you guys?
Really, I'm glad that I heard eToy's approach on it. Because, I mean, as we spoke already of our favorite parts of Earthbound, and you can just come out of it with something that is unique to you. And it'll teach you something. You'll leave feeling a different way about certain things. And it's just a great game that has influenced so many people. Again, we wouldn't be sitting in this room talking to each other without it. And
none of us would know each other
exactly.
Without this game. That is another pretty poignant thing to say.
It will sound really cliche to say Earthbound is more than a game, but yeah. I think it comes to that because it's made by a guy who doesn't make video games.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's why that comes into play.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
Just to remember that connection, that it's not just someone narrated to you his ideas about the world, and then you sort of enjoy it.
We. That's right. We are the Fangamer Podcast. We're popular, but not rich.
Earthbound is a... Life is full of... It's one long journey of trying to find some kind of truth to hold on to, and I think this is a game that's full of many little elegant truths. And if only for that reason alone, people should play it.
Absolutely.
Next week, we'll be doing the first of our War Month episodes, and we'll actually hopefully be releasing two of those episodes next week.
They'll be divided throughout the rest of the month.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But look forward to those. Call us in if you have... call us if you have anything to say about Earthbound again, I guess, and War Games.
Yeah, 503-446-CAST is the number to call.
Thanks again, everybody, for sending in your voicemails for this week, as well as our different Fangamer friends for sending in their thoughts on Earthbound. Thanks again, Lindsay, for sharing your magnificent journey that I think it's really making this episode.
Because
I don't think we're saying anything that hasn't been said before, except for that segment. So I want to thank you for
I hope to have many more of that. So.
Oh, yeah. I think you will.
Yeah.
And, Lindsay, where can people find your blog?
I am at yomuka.wordpress.com. That's yomuka.wordpress.com.
Yomuka.
And that'll be in the description. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Jeff Benson and Ben...
Karenyan.
I was going to say the man Ben. Oh. Charlie, Spirit Duck Verdon, and Lindsay Nelson.
Spirit duck?
Charlie's a spirit duck. His spirit animal's a duck.
You did face the wrath of that duck last night, if you remember.
Bye, everybody!
Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for listening. Off to fight the sharks. Off to fight the sharks. Hey, look, there's
took out half your party with a stupid
Shut your dick.
There you go, that's the end right there.